Welcome to Human Risk, a podcast dedicated to the understanding of human behaviour as a risk. Here's your host, Christian Hunt.
Hello and welcome back to the Human Risk podcast. On this episode, I'm exploring the often hidden role that luck can play when it comes to being successful. In other words, are we doing well just because we've got talent and ability? Or are we doing well because we just got lucky? Very often, we focus on the former and ignore the latter. And for reasons you'll hear on this episode, that can produce some bad outcomes. This area is something that my guest, Odessa Hamilton, has specialised in researching. She's a behavioural science researcher at the Inclusion Initiative, which is part of the London School of Economics and Political Science. It's the second in a series of episodes featuring guests from the initiative, so if you missed the previous one, do have a listen to my interview with Cecily Justin. I'm absolutely fascinated by this subject from a human risk perspective, both on a personal but also on a professional level. As someone who came from a privileged background, I had, until I started to look at this area in more detail, attributed most of my successes to my ability rather than getting lucky. But the more I've looked into it, the more I've realised the significant part that luck has and continues to play in my life. What you're about to hear are some fascinating insights. So please enjoy my discussion with Odessa Hamilton of the Inclusion Initiative on luck versus skill. Odessa, welcome to the Human Risk Podcast.
Thank you for having me. Very excited about today.
I'm really excited to have you here. And look, before we get into the subject we want to talk about, can you tell my listeners a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. I'm a behavioural science researcher at the Inclusion Initiative, which is part of the LSE's Department of Psychological and Behavioural Science. I should probably say a little bit about what I do there. I develop and prescribe a range of pragmatic solutions to major behavioural issues experienced across organisations. My priority is to bring about sustained and scalable change. I exploit causal statistical methods to test my assumptions, and I use the findings to inform industry by offering solutions that are underpinned by science. That is a mouthful, I know.
What does that mean in practice? What would a sort of intervention you've been involved with or research you've been involved with, the Boyd Goodig example?
So today, actually, we're going to be talking about, hopefully, this idea of skill versus luck and how we kind of ignore luck in skill evaluations when we're thinking about success and the success of other people. So that's one research project that we're working on at the moment. And yeah, we'll hopefully delve in deeper.
Amazing. Tell us a little bit about the Inclusion Initiative. What is that?
So essentially, we're trying to get an idea of what things underpin inclusion and diversity and also equality, and making sure that we can leverage those things to bring about change.
Fascinating. And obviously, I'm really interested in inclusion. If we want to solve the problem for the 21st century, we need more brains looking at these particular issues. So we need to bring people in that maybe historically haven't been involved in that. And we've seen examples. We could think about governments. We could think about companies where you get this kind of groupthink. And so the way that we can resolve that is to start thinking, how do we bring more people in? How do we bring different forms of experiences and thought processes in to kind of solve those problems? So from a kind of human risk perspective, I'm fascinated by it because I think what it's doing is really, yes, there's definitely a moral side which says, we shouldn't be excluding people. That just feels morally wrong. But actually, there's a really practical business and societal benefit to saying, hey, if we had some other people involved in this, we'll get better answers.
Absolutely. And you have to think about it this way. If your business model and the people within your business are diverse, think about the range of people that you can really connect to. And that's really what you want. And it really helps towards it. It's an excellent business model. And you can see it in quantifiable metrics on the bottom line as well. It's a no-brainer.
So let's explore what sort of areas are you looking at when it comes to inclusion?
So my particular focus at the moment is this whole idea of skill versus luck and evaluations or attributions of success. So we engage in sense-making to navigate and simplify what's a complex and dynamic world. So we construct groups to predict, control, and master phenomena that we encounter. And this perception of success and how it's attributed is a fundamental occupational concern, and it has important implications for occupational engagement. And for that reason, it can be seen as a crucial inclusion and diversity leverage. This whole idea that individuals frequently conflate luck with skill evaluations, and we ignore how future performance tends to regress towards the mean, meaning we all veer towards a statistical average. So our performance kind of levels out across the board. But the problem is that we often attribute success to immutable factors such as gender, race, class, appearance, personality, age, health, physical ability, and so forth. And ignoring the role of luck conceals and, if you want to say, enhances privilege, even if not deliberately or consciously invoked.
So in other words, when we try to assess maybe how qualified somebody is or how well they've done, we'd say, okay, well, they've achieved all of these things, and therefore that must be down to them being brilliant at whatever it is.
Right.
And actually what you're saying is, well, there's a huge amount of luck, which might be, I mean, might just literally be you've made a random stab at something and got it right. Mm-hmm. Or it might be you had a better education, more opportunities, and therefore you haven't had to struggle in the same way as certain other people. You've had a huge amount of advantages in life. And therefore, of course, your performance is going to look better. And so if we just start to judge people based on, you know, how they've done so far, we're missing the simple thing that actually that's not a fair assessment. And you're just, therefore, in essence, if you looked at it sort of from a raw material perspective, actually, you're not judging those things equally. And so the person that you think is performing incredibly well actually might not do as well as you, might not have as much potential as someone else, but we conflate because we're conflating those two things. And so that's from the organizational perspective. And I guess there's also a lot of people confuse those things in their own life. And so it's like, I'm brilliant at this without recognizing that they've had a huge head start.
Exactly that, precisely. I think there's this whole overall sense that what we find that observers tend to ignore the existence of situational factors. So with the belief that they're waiting exclusively on these personal qualities that you've named, like skill, ability, effort, and this reliance on distributional attributions for what may be situational effects creates a fallacy, given that success is fundamentally a byproduct of both dispositional and situational factors, or skill and luck.
When we look at that, you talked about how this sort of continues to build in prejudice. Can you just talk a little bit about how the compound effect, if you like, of this dynamic?
Yeah, so misattributions of luck and performance can develop into false expectations on either side of the spectrum. So because you think someone's brilliant, you maybe put them into a role that they can't manage. And then because you think someone is less brilliant, you put them into a role where they're really overqualified, not in the traditional sense, but they really have skills that could be better placed in a more senior role. But you put them in a, you know, junior role because on paper, they don't look a certain way. And of course, when misattributions systematically differ by diffuse characteristics, it impacts high stake outcomes in the labor market, such as pay, promotions, and opportunities. And so you see this, like the pay gap, for example.
I mean, I find this fascinating because if you look at any other use of resources, right, deployment of resources, at its simplest, wasting money and wasting resources because we're putting them in the wrong place and we're not getting the best possible, I guess what my dad would always refer to as tools for the job, right, is that we're looking through the wrong lens. And so purely, even if you didn't want to include the sort of the moral angle on it, just from an economic perspective, that's dumb, right? It's an inefficient use of resources. Looks at any other use of resources, right? Deployment of resources, whether that was sort of machinery or IT equipment, anything like that, you would say, well, we want to make sure we get the best we possibly can, right? We need the best possible use of that because it's a valuable commodity. And yet somehow for the human side of it, we get that badly wrong, right? And so what we're doing, if we don't address some of these issues, is the moral angle on it. Just from an economic perspective, that's dumb. But it's an inefficient use of resources.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you want people to be in roles where they feel that they're making a difference, that they can feel that success and that they can thrive in it. And if we're putting people in the wrong places, it's not good for them. And of course, by inference, then it's not good for the business.
You talked about the pay gap, which brings us nicely onto the topic of gender. Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing in that space? Because that's a really obvious example, I think, where we all know that, you know, there's statistics out there, but we all kind of conceptually know that there are certain reasons why women are disadvantaged. Can you talk a little bit about the dynamic and what you're doing in that space?
Well, funny enough, gender can be one of the most polarizing issues, perhaps because it creates this kind of male against female narrative. Of course, it doesn't have to be that way and often isn't. But the issue is that historically, men have been thought to be more competent than women, which of course is a clear disadvantage to women seeking managerial, executive, or more senior or male-dominated roles, despite information being offered that contradicts the stereotype. And the concept of success has been, if you want to say, epitomized through maleness. So men are typically seen as being instrumental in their own success, whereas women are typically seen as being passive. And therefore, you have this dynamic where male success is inherently explained by ability, but let's say the unexpected outcome of a woman's success or stereocontrastive outcome tends to be explained by luck or other mutable, unstable causes. So this means that, again, men become more disproportionately rewarded for what is thought to be skill without regard to the ease through which earlier successes may have been afforded.
And so we end up with completely skewed view and, I guess, ultimately appointment of people into roles that just is, one, it's unfair. But secondly, we get some really bad outcomes because, to put it simply, we have incompetent people in positions that they really shouldn't be in. Exactly. That is causing, you know, societal problems. We don't have to look too far in terms of politics to see that in action, where people are, you know, there are men who have been put simply overpromoted or put positions they shouldn't be in.
Exactly. And again, this can be harmful to men when hired into or promoted into roles where failure is foreseeable. And then the flip side of that is that women can be overlooked for employment, promotion, or opportunity because of a perceived rather than an actual skill deficit. So you have this dynamic where women are deemed unworthy of the positions that they hold, they're excluded from key discourse, they're given less credit, people see them as outliers when they're successful rather than, you know, something that can be generalized to women more broadly.
So all of those dynamics are there. Mm-hmm. And so how do you start looking at them? Because I could totally see what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I get it. How do you research this? Because when you start, you know, it certainly, I'll be quite frank about this, mm-hmm. wasn't obvious to me a lot of this stuff until a few years ago when I started to think about it. And I'd always looked at my career, I have been tremendously successful. And I probably have been very successful. I'm not going to question the success thing, but why did that happen? Well, the answer is I had quite a big head start, not least the color of my skin, my sex, and the education I had. So I'm aware of that. But I started looking at, okay, we're going to ask from, what do we do about it? Because as I look at attempts to solve the problem, you end up with awful things like quotas that can build resentment, possibly not even solve the problem appropriately. So as you've recognized the issue, how do you go about thinking about researching and solving it?
I think the first step, of course, is getting people to realize that, you know, this is a problem and what the underlying issues are. So this whole idea of attributions is fairly under-researched. It's quite a niche area and many people are quite surprised by it, although, you know, anecdotally, we see it all the time and we hear it, but we don't really understand what's happening on the undercurrents. So as to what we do about it, I think representation is key. I think we need to diversify the workforce, but we need to diversify it at every level, including board level. And I think we always take this kind of bottom-up approach when in fact we need to take a top-down approach. And that's not historically been the case.
And so that's not just a function of it'll take time for people to grow up through the organization. That's also the sorts of decision-making that we needs to happen at those higher levels.
Absolutely.
To be able to sort of drive the structural change that we needed to make this happen.
Absolutely. I read a recent piece in The Guardian that that spoke of the stark differences in rewards between men and women achieving first-class degrees. And the increase in pay for women receiving a first-class degree over a 2-1 was negligible, but it was around 14% for men, which suggests that as compared to men, less high-achieving women are then going on to secure high-earning careers. So we see these things playing out in the news and the media quite often, but we're not really understanding why that happens. So I think really the first step is understanding why something's happening, and then we can look to solutions.
And so that's what you're focusing on, is really sort of looking and saying, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. How are you conducting your research in this space? Is this around looking at structures and the impact they have? Are you tracking groups of people? How do you go about looking at that? Because a lot of this, you know, what I find fascinating about this is a lot of this stuff is sort of ingrained. Mm-hmm. And it's that, you know, to use the classic behavioral science terminology, this is system one thinking as opposed to system two. Mm-hmm. And so we're really, it's a lot harder than just sort of saying to people, why are you doing that? And expecting the answer. Because there's certain things where you can ask people and what they say has a reasonable likelihood of being an accurate reflection of what's going on. But in this case, that's really clearly not happening because it's so embedded in the process. So how are you thinking about researching this?
So I'm actually with Dr. Grace Lorden. We're doing a systematic review, which will hopefully soon be coming out, published. And it's really looking at what research is out there and pulling it all together to get an understanding of what is happening in terms of attributions and success. The other members of the team are engaging in qualitative studies and also quant. So there's quite a mixture and quite a broad range between the team of how we're going about addressing the same issue, coming at it from different angles.
I said you're going out there saying, who has, not necessarily, I guess, with this specific objective in mind, but who's been looking at this challenge previously? So what can we collate and learn from that so we can build on what they've done or understand the challenges of it, as opposed to just starting fresh. And then you've got colleagues that are looking at that sort of fresh field work.
Right. So I've been looking at it from a historical point of view in terms of what has been researched, has there been change, and has the change been because of change minds, or has the change been because people understand that they can no longer say and do things that are, you know, politically incorrect, for example. And so they've adapted their way of behavior. So that's kind of the perspective that I'm taking.
So in other words, have they genuinely changed as people, or are they just conforming to what they perceive to be a changed social norm?
Precisely.
In other words, I still think it, but I'm not allowed to say anything.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. How are you finding that? I mean, is it presumably it's a combination of those factors, or is it we've genuinely got more sophisticated?
I definitely think that there has been change, but there is this idea of social desirability in responses, and a lot of the authors have actually commented on that.
Meaning that people are saying the thing they think they ought to say.
Yes. That they know it's not, for example, right to say that women are only in their success. So they won't say it.
Right. Okay. But it hasn't actually changed the underlying. That's really interesting. Okay. And so we're trying to grapple with, is this just literally that, you know, as you say, the term political correctness, I think is interesting because it's sort of, I'm never quite sure what it means, but I understand conceptually what you're saying, which is this sort of, I'm not allowed to say that. I would have, like 20 years ago, I would have happily said that, but I can't say that anymore. So I'm just going to give the right exam answer because I don't want to look out of whack. But underneath it all, I'm still cleaving to those beliefs that I would have had 20 years ago.
Precisely.
Wow. I'm fascinated by that. How do they go and deal with that? Is that a case of looking at words and actions and comparing the two things? Is that how they solve that particular thing? How do they recognize which of the two it is?
They do kind of like a litmus test, if you want to say. So they check to see whether or not the participants kind of understood what was happening in the study. And if they did, they try to adjust for that in the results. So the results ultimately are empirical and underpinned by truth, but there is this kind of controlling for social desirability in the results.
Fascinating. Wow. That's very interesting. And so we've talked a little bit about gender, and I want to make sure we also look at the obvious thing that flows from that, which is health. Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing in that space?
So people seldom think about health, actually, until it compels them. There's a saying, it's said that health is a staple of wealth, and there's no health without mental health. And so you see they're all intertwined. Although health, whether physical or mental, creates a slightly different dynamic to one's socio-demographic status as it follows a different trajectory, and of course is a less stable construct. I would say it's fair to say that it's not even in the same playing field as the others. People with health conditions and disabilities have an added burden that takes away from the single focus of that an otherwise fit and able-bodied person typically has. So they're forced to try harder for the same rewards, the road is rockier, they have to be more relentless, etc. I can give you, for example, take competitive swimmers, for example. One's sight compared, perhaps with low visual acuity and or no light perception, so has to overcome the added burden of navigating this disability by refocusing just a portion of attention to this audible sound of tapping while in the water. And this is in addition to being intently focused to their speed and their technique and their accuracy, like all the other swimmers. So interestingly, most people would accept that they have this added challenge or disadvantage, right? And would not think twice about the role of luck. But what of those conditions that aren't apparent or immediately discernible, like diabetes or autoimmunity or bipolar disorder or a plethora of other conditions, much too many to name here.
And I think it's really interesting, like, because we, you know, there are obvious examples where we can all find ourselves in situations where we struggle slightly. So I was thinking about, go to a country where you don't speak the language as a good example. And you are having to concentrate much more about what is going on, because otherwise you won't get fed, you won't get where you want to get to. There's a whole load of things that won't happen. So there's a lot more effort required. And for me, that's a really interesting parallel with what you're talking about here, which is we all instinctively know what it means to be sort of bogged down by some faculty that we don't necessarily have. So the language would be, and of course you're right, if somebody's carrying a health condition, that is debilitating on some level, and therefore they're unable to respond to things. And because most, you know, health is interesting, as you say, physical disabilities are obvious, but in many cases, you know, the mental ones are not. And so it becomes much, much harder. And so I think that's a really interesting piece that says, okay, not only, and this I guess brings us to a broader thing about when we talk about inclusion, it's not just people that look differently. It's people with all sorts of, so it's this neurodivergence that we need to think about, and therefore bring in people like that. So it's the same challenge, if you like, but it's just, I guess it's less obvious, right? In the things you're talking about, because that generally speaking, we can look and say, well, that's, you know, male, female, it becomes a sort of relatively obvious piece. This is much more hidden, and so much more challenging.
It's much more difficult to deal with these type of issues that people experience and create a balance in the workforce. And also it's harder to judge success for the same reason. So like I said, someone who has had, you know, some sort of health condition that's had to really strive to succeed a lot harder than perhaps their peers or their colleagues, that's not necessarily rewarded in the same way. And they may have been held back to some extent, and that's not accounted for. So it's very difficult to manage and judge.
And I always think it's really interesting. If you look at something like autism, those people have, and I love the Greta Thunberg articulation of her. She's autistic, and she basically says that's a superpower, because she's able to look at things in different ways. And I read these great stories. There was a kid who was autistic and was given a job in a burger joint, and they realized he wasn't very good at some of the physical things, but he was brilliant at remembering orders, right? And so they just had him doing that particular thing. And I think that's a really good example of where, you know, to your point, is the way that we assess people, the roles that we create for people, it's a game that's been structured in a particular way, mm-hmm. which is it sort of judges people on the way. And so who do we hire to do these particular roles? Well, we'll look at traditional skill sets. What things do we expect of people in that role? Well, we'll look at traditional sort of skill set. And who do we promote? We look at traditional pieces. Mm-hmm. And actually, what's interesting, we're leaving a ton of value on the table, because if we could start to structure jobs around recognizing where people aren't so good, and also recognizing where they could be amazing, and rather than having to people and say, do you fit into this job size box? Let's start to try and think about how can we create jobs for people that take advantage of these things. Mm-hmm. And so I think it seems to me that it's, you know, step one is to say, let's recognize this dynamic is happening. And then let's go in and look at how we structure our processes so that we can get the best of people. So that, put it in simple terms, we're not wasting time giving people things they're not very good at, because they don't enjoy it and they're not very good at it. So that's not a very good reason. But we can start to really focus. And I guess that takes us into what do job roles mean and all of these sorts of pieces. Once we open this up, we've got a great opportunity to start thinking how we can get the best out of people.
Absolutely. I mean, we do this in terms of personality as well. We have a preference towards extroversion over introversion. But in fact, we really need a combination of the two in the workforce. So again, it's about having balance in the workforce, understanding what unique skills each person can bring to the table, and not necessarily always valuing one over the other. It's about that blend.
And so this is really an interesting get. You start with an obvious problem, mm-hmm. which is this sort of lack of inclusion. Some people are excluded. Mm-hmm. From the processes, and you say, okay, well, we want to try and investigate that and find out why it happens, and to try and then obviously the next step is to deal with that piece. But really, as we're talking here, I mean, we're unpicking quite a lot of, I won't say conventional wisdom, but I kind of mean it in the sense of the way we've always done things. Mm-hmm. And so we have designed structures that are perpetuating the status quo, the current way of thinking things. And so really what you're picking at here is that you've identified some fundamental challenges, which if you were starting again and you were trying to get the best out, you wouldn't design things this way. And so we're dealing really with some major structural challenges that are perpetuating, as you point out, these challenges.
Yeah, I mean, take class, for example. Within the UK especially, the potential for social mobility is very limited. And an individual's social strata is commonly tied to the social order that they're born into. And then, of course, the problem with that is that benefits are bestowed upon individuals from different classes, different, such that success can then again become a function of the privilege that class affords or the constraints that imposes, rather than merit. And then again, you have this failure to discount luck and the exaggeration or over-exaggeration of ability. And you're getting the same kind of reoccurring problems over and over again, but just with different attributes or traits.
What I find fascinating about this is that when you talk to people who have been quote-unquote successful, mm-hmm. right, in the current system, they will very often talk about, you use words like meritocracy. because they recognize intuitively that there is a need to justify their position and success by dint of talent or ability. So innately, they kind of know that that's necessary. And it's something about, you know, I have to just, how do I get legitimate authority in this company, in this society, in this, is the answer is I need to be able to justify why I'm here. And so I rely on lots of language of things that probably isn't true. The meritocracy being my favorite example, where anybody that any senior person that feels the need to say it, I always think is compensating for the fact that it's clearly not one. Because if it was one, it'd be blindingly obvious and you wouldn't need to say it. And secondly, if you're making that sort of speech, you're obviously in a senior position with an audience, right? It's not the sort of thing you'd say to someone one-on-one. Exactly. And so I find it really, really fascinating that we have this basic human need to justify things through that. You know, the reason I have a title, I have an experience, I got this degree, and therefore that's why I'm allowed to do this particular thing. So we understand this intuitively, and yet it's based on, I'll be slightly radical here, it's based on lies in many cases.
Exactly. I mean, another example can be seen again in early career, like many in the higher social stratums, I was fortunate enough to be able to volunteer for an extended period of time while studying. And this was in contrast to some of my peers that had no choice but to work alongside their studies to meet essential food and housing needs, etc. And so this difference, which kind of is often overlooked, that this difference meant that I could engage in more meaningful career-focused work experience rather than an unrelated role in, say, retail, for example. And there you see having resources narrow social mobility. Therefore, you see that having resources narrows social mobility and feeds into this myth of meritocracy, because some people do have a head start, but that's not to say that they're not hardworking, intelligent, diligent, etc. But it circles back to this idea that success is a byproduct of skill or luck. And there is a lot of pushback to this whole idea of luck. And I think it's because ignoring luck in the role of success is said to fulfill the most basic needs of an individual at the upper end of the, because it's protecting their self-esteem and also their self-value. Think about it. We all want to feel like we are responsible for our own success. There's a feel-good factor, taking ownership of the good things that occur in our lives. And by contrast, we tend to look to external explanations for our failures. And another reason for the pushback against this notion of luck is that it challenges ingrained convictions on wealth-related meritocracy, which has the potential to disrupt the existing societal benefits and structures. And that, of course, can alter power dynamics. And, well, those in power, of course, don't want to lose it. So it's quite controversial for that reason.
I mean, it is interesting, right? Because if the moment I start to dissect my own privilege, and it started to feel incredibly uncomfortable, because okay, the only reason, and I sort of can track it back, is I went to a really good university. The only reason you got into that university is because you had a really good education. Like, and at what point have I added some value here, or have I just been a passenger to event? Now, I certainly haven't been lazy in my past, but there is an interesting parallel universe question for me about to say, well, if I'd been born into a different environment, would I have had without those opportunities, would I have been successful? I think that success, quote unquote, would have looked very different. It might have looked the same, but I find it's pretty unlikely. But that, as you say, that's a really uncomfortable thing to think about, because it makes me feel kind of useless.
Exactly.
Because there's nothing, in many respects, if I wanted to take my sort of anger around this to a logical extremity, I would be just go, but that means like, that's an attack on me. I mean, it's not like I've done nothing. In simple terms, you know, I have to recognize that I sort of had either call it a head start, or you can call it a sort of tailwind, but there was something helping me do the things that I've done. And of course, you're right. The moment you start to point that out to people, that feels, it makes people feel a bit useless. And of course, you don't want to give up the privileges that come with that. And so that's quite a big challenge. And so I find it interesting when you talk about that. I mean, are you finding opposition to the idea of what you're doing? Are there lots of people sort of sniping at the sidelines on this? Because I could see some vested interest looking at this going, I'm not sure I like where this is going.
Well, I think it is an uncomfortable place. And none of us, again, like to be told that, you know, it's only because we're privileged that we're successful. And actually, it does feel like an attack in many ways. And so that's why you have this kind of pushback and, kind of diatribe between groups. But again, it doesn't have to be that way. It can just be you accept that your success is a weighted byproduct of skill and luck, and that's fine. And just making that acknowledgement and seeing that and understanding that other people's road has not been as smooth or as straight, that's okay. You know, you don't have to be beaten over the head with it. There's no need to apologize for it either. It's just understanding that there are differences between, you know, people's experiences, and some may have to have worked harder than others.
And that's a really interesting point, actually, because I think there is a lot of sort of, it feels like, well, I need to flagellate myself. there's nothing one can do about it. In respect, because if you'd be given something, of course, right, you'd be, it'd be slightly weird to turn around at a young age and go, well, I don't want that. Right. I know that's a vector, but I'm going to ignore that and do other things. That wouldn't be an intelligent decision. Right. And so I think that's a really interesting observation there, that this idea of inclusion isn't about saying, well, let's just attack the people that have these things. It's about saying let's try and bring the average level up.
Right.
As opposed to kind of knocking these people down off their pedestal. Now, implicitly, that it does feel like a little bit of a winner and loser game. And if I admit this, then I'm going to have to give up certain things. But it also is quite liberating when you start to think in those terms, because suddenly I recognize that I think it always allows you to recognize what your true value is, because I start to sort of sit there and say, okay, what I can think about certain things that I've benefited from that definitely came directly from the education that I've had. But then there've been other things that I've hustled myself and made happen. Now, as a result of having that, sure, but I've sort of been able to, and so in many respects, I think it allows you to value much more the things that you are, the skills that you can bring, as opposed to the bits that are elements. And of course, they're difficult to disaggregate, but I think it's quite healthy to be able to pick that out and to start to then say, well, I can feel really proud of those things. And perhaps I should be less proud of the degree that I got at the university that I went to, because maybe that wasn't all my own doing. Whereas some of the other things that possibly don't come with a qualification, don't come with a badge, maybe much more me being uniquely me and bringing my own skills as opposed to the luck that I came with.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that people have to understand it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. It also doesn't have to be a them against us situation. What it is about getting people in the right roles for them. You know, getting people in the right roles for them, and getting people in, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say, do you know what I just looked at? It was recording. I forgot all this time it was recording. I just
No, that's the whole. That's watching you. It's just a conversation, right? No, now it's like I totally get that. Do you know what's really funny I've interviewed some like really interesting people. So I've had comedians. There are a few guests where I've kind of really fanboyed, and I'm like, I'm a gibbering wreck, and I'm like, I'm recording. This is embarrassing. This is going to go out. And it's the moment I just calm the hell down, and it's a conversation, that it all flows brilliantly. And the moment you start to realize, like you look at the camera and you watch it a bit, that recording thing is really unhelpful. So I totally get it.
Sorry about that.
No, don't worry. It's quite fair. It's human. It's totally human. This is really, by the way, don't forget, this is weird, right? Because what we're doing here, we've got the whole sort of weird 2D, we're talking to each other through digital technology. That's weird. And the second thing is, I'm having a conversation with you that is sort of a private conversation, but what we know is going to go out there. And we're talking about an area where, on the one hand, you're incredibly comfortable because it's your area of specialism. On the other hand, you're like, where? And particularly, I know that my line of questioning in conversation, right, is a bit, you're like, where the hell's he going with this? But you can't quite predict where I'm going to come out, because what I'm doing is just listening to what you're saying, thinking about it, and trying to have a conversation. And we don't normally record conversations that we have, right? If we're having this in a coffee shop, right, we'd be fine, but we're recording this conversation. The recording thing, I think there's a psychological thing that goes, hold on a minute, we were just having a one-on-one chat, and now there's something I'd forgotten about. Whoa, that's not. So yeah, totally get it.
So I guess, where was I going? It doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. Really, what we want is people to be placed in the right roles for them, and we want to make sure that companies are diverse. That diversity helps the individuals, the teams, but also on a more macro level, it's helping the companies and also society more broadly.
And that's sort of, I guess when we come to look at the practicalities of that, I mean, that feels like a major shift, right? Which is the other thing here is that sort of if I took what you're saying to a logical extremity, I'd be going, but that requires us to fundamentally rethink blah 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's true. Mm-hmm. You know, to say there is quite a lot of change, the structural change that's going to be required to make this stuff happen. On the other hand, we could look at that thing and say, well, we can never change all of these things. We don't want to change all these things and tradition and blah, 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 blah. Right? I would turn around and get anything that's a step in that direction has got to be a good thing. And so we could take baby steps in this direction just by recognizing it. And I guess implicit in your pieces, you're not looking, you know, this is evolution, not revolution. Mm-hmm. Ideally, we'd like to get to a stage where we solve this problem. But actually, there are lots of small things that can happen. A little bit like, I guess, like climate, is we mm-hmm. sort of look at the scale of the problem and are freaked out by it and go, well, what's my little thing going to do when all these other people... But actually, we can all take baby steps and move it in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And to your point around social norms shifting, yeah, this isn't an impossible ask. And this isn't a sort of like, let's burn everything to the ground and start again. But this is just a like an evolutionary thing that if we started to understand a bit more, think about it a bit more, we've got opportunities to make very small changes to start with that will have big impact. And then we can go from there.
There are so many, you're absolutely right. There are so many small things that we can do or even look at to adjust. So even just these biases and attributions of success, they're subject to a number of moderating factors that can be leveraged to affect change. For example, the emotional distribution of one toward another is said to be crucial to the direction of the attribution. So what I mean by that is attributions of success will favor people who are similar to ourselves or when we have shared traits or values or expectations. So essentially, when we find commonality with someone, we tend to attribute more fairly and more objectively than when we don't. And again, this is why representation matters. And then you have feelings of stress, exhaustion, or inundation. When someone's
inundated.
Sorry. Feelings of stress, exhaustion, or inundation can lead to errors in attributions, but also feelings of elation can have the same effect. And what's happening here is under these type of conditions, we tend to be more impulsive and less thoughtful. So we make more mistakes or we become more subjective in our judgments. And in the same way, reflective individuals are less likely to make attribution errors. And so when you look at that, you can say, okay, so how can this condition be simulated? And one thing you can do is make people feel accountable to others, because we tend to be more careful or vigilant in our decision-making when we're made to feel accountable of our actions. Granted, this is primarily out of fear of repercussions, and it's certainly more egocentric, say, but it works. For instance, we know that we're less likely to speed in our cars when we risk a penalty, or if even, all right, even take the laws just passed, so we'd follow COVID guidelines. So we tend to do things more objectively and more kind of to the rules when we have a risk to ourselves. It's not right, but it's just what it is.
Right. So in other words, to take speeding, for example, you're saying like, if it feels like a safe stretch of road, and of course our perception of the risk might be wrong, but if we make it, I know, on the motorway at 2 o'clock in the morning, there's no other traffic there, mm-hmm. that's a much safer time to speed than it might be if there was tons of traffic and loads of big trucks there that we might have an accident, and maybe there's some roadworks and lots of other things going on. So mm-hmm. we will make an assessment there and go, actually that, and it's not a sort of conscious kind of right, well, weigh these things up. It's just like sort of gut reaction. Is like if that's 2 a.m. speeding scenario feels a lot more legitimate mm-hmm. than the roadworks, loads of trucks, foggy conditions, let's say, and therefore that's the sort of thing you're talking about.
Well, it's more if I'm on a 30 mile per hour stretch and I know there's a camera.
Right.
And I'm more likely to stick to that 30 miles per hour stretch knowing that there's a speed camera than if there wasn't. I'm more likely to go 40, say,
right.
Or dare I say it, 50.
Hopefully. It's a hypothetical example. Right? You're obviously not talking about your real driving people. I get the point theoretically.
Right. And, you know, again, on the motorway, if it's clear, you're more likely to do 80 miles an hour rather than stick to the 70 because you want to get home.
Right. Wow. So as we look at, so we've looked at gender bit we've followed the flow through onto health. Are there any other areas that you that sort of are interesting to you that you sort of either are exploring or going to move on to explore?
Well, there's this whole idea of you have this added dynamic and complexity of intersectionality in our reflections of success. So imagine combining even just the three characteristics that we discussed here today in one individual. And intersectionality is this idea that social identity, such as age, race, class, disability, gender, etc., they interact to form qualitatively different meanings and experiences. And it invites layers of discrimination, if you will. So, of course, this makes things more complex as the respective oppressions are interlinked. And
so can you just unpack that? What's a practical example? Should I get my head around this in terms of the intersectionality piece? Does that mean like all of these things kicking up together? Is that the point?
Well, so for example, being Muslim and disabled together does not necessarily equate to a double experience of discrimination. It could be injustice squared, for example. So it's difficult to understand and statistically quantify the additive effects of intersectionality, because belonging to multiple marginalized groups does not necessarily equate to an equivalent ratio of outcomes.
Right. And so you're sort of looking at that and saying, this makes it even more complicated.
Exactly.
And therefore, it's as we bring in more attributes that people might have that would potentially lead them to being disadvantaged in some way, or excluded, I guess, for the bigger piece, that starts to get even more challenging.
Absolutely. And of course, they're all interlinked and can't necessarily be separated, because of course, we're not each of those things at a single point in time, we're all of those things simultaneously. And unfortunately, intersectionality is very poorly understood, sparsely researched, and there are very few solutions, and none to my knowledge, that relate to this fairly niche area of attributions of success. There are, of course, more broad stroke based solutions, such as system level solutions with broad partnerships and changes in social norms rather than individualistic solutions. There's also changing the employment infrastructure rather than bolting on a load of diversity initiatives. But that's really the area that needs so much work and so much focus right now.
I'm fascinated by the words you use there about bolting on, because it does seem to me that when we look at many of the ways that people try to solve this is very performative. Mm-hmm. So we'll do, the classic example for me is always, what does the photo look like in the boardroom? Ah, well, let's just make sure the photo looks a bit better.
Exactly.
And we solve that problem by parachuting someone in at that level so that we can say we've ticked that box. Doesn't it look good? Are we great? And maybe we have a diversity team whose job it is to sort of do what they can, but we're not making fundamental changes to the organization. Because right. That would be too difficult, stroke, not something I want to do, stroke, expensive, insert excuse here. And so this bolting on thing, I think, is really interesting, because it seems to me, and I'd be fascinated to get your views on it, it seems to me that often those sort of initiatives can be actually detrimental, because everybody knows it's performative, and you end up making it really difficult, because if you happen to have a, white male boardroom, so just parachuting a black woman in there, is if they're not necessarily obviously qualified to do it, that can be problematic and everybody sees it for what it is. And therefore, far from sending a signal that you care about this, you actually send exactly the opposite signal, which is we really don't care about this. We're just doing what we need to do to be seen to be doing it. And so as we look at these solutions, it does seem to me that there is a knee-jerk reaction to, and in some cases, well-motivated to get on with stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So I'll do the kind of bolt and foot. But actually there are some, this is much more in the longer term about changing the structures and dealing with those pieces. And so I wonder what you thought about some of the sort of more performative, quick fix things. Am I right in my assessment, or are those actually helpful in some way, shape or form?
You are absolutely right. They are not helpful. They're harmful. And there's a word for it. It's called tokenism. People see it for what it is. They see right through it and it's not helpful. So we really need to think about, more meaningful interventions and really, again, not being performative as you said, really looking to real change, sustainable change. And through that, people can see that you actually care. And that matters, actually.
It's interesting, actually, you used the word sustainable, which I'd never really thought about it. But actually, taking my example of parachuting that single black woman into the white male boardroom, if for whatever reason she decides to leave, you haven't solved the problem at all. It's not sustainable in any way, shape, or form, because actually you're just going to have to do the way you solve that problem is to do it again. So it's almost like if we looked in sort of a different example, it's kind of like we can, if you've got a country where people are starving, fine, do some emergency food drops, but also teach them how to grow their own food and how make sure they've got, because otherwise it's not building a sustainable solution. It's constantly going to require these sorts of interventions. And so that's I hadn't thought about that before. That's a really interesting perspective of saying actually these things aren't sustainable and they don't feel sustainable. And they're a quick fix. Mm-hmm. It's like a sort of diet pill that doesn't really work, but we can kid ourselves that it does. And that's it. But of course, to solve these things properly requires much more effort and takes a lot longer. And so I'm struck by the parallels between, you talked about things that are invisible. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, if you want to change structures, that involves changing a lot of things behind the scenes.
Exactly.
Adapting processes. And sure, you can do PR and all those sorts of things, but you'd have to really change the mechanics of it, your processes that you use. And some of that may not be immediately visible. Mm-hmm. And so there's some hard yards to be done behind the scenes that won't be visible to any.
Right. And you also have to think about if you have a boardroom of, say, white men, and you put a black woman in that boardroom, what's her support system? What's her network? How is she being, what does she have to navigate in order to maintain that position? What type of opposition is she facing and facing alone, likely? And so there's so much around the appointment of an individual that needs to be considered in terms of sustainability.
That's really interesting. Wow. The time with you has absolutely flown. I will put links to the inclusion initiative in the show notes. Anything else you want to share with listeners? But as a final question, and we've got a sense of where you're going to go. Is there anything else that we should have talked about that we haven't managed to cover?
Actually, one thing that we haven't spoken about is collectivist societies. I don't know where this really fits in, but in terms of solutions, I think we have much to learn from collectivistic societies.
Do you want to just explain what that means for people who might not be familiar with the term?
So the idea is that when we're in Western worlds, we're quite individualistic. We think about ourselves, and in collectivist societies, they have a centralized focus on the we, the us, the our, rather than the I, which makes them more aware of the needs and the wants or desires of others. And through this focus outward, they're less vulnerable to attribution errors. They're less vulnerable to making decisions that are harmful towards others. So I just feel that we have much to learn and gain from this approach.
And so that's really taking a kind of tribal approach to life and really saying we need to look after each other.
Exactly.
And So I guess that puts you at odds with, for example, concept of shareholder value and profit maximization and saying, actually, yeah, I can do that. But that also involves exploiting the planet and ripping people off, whatever. And so there's some negative side effects of that, if you like.
Right.
And so you're basically saying if we start to redesign the way society operates, and I think it's interesting when you will reflect on COVID and that sudden awareness that we all had of the people making things work behind the scenes. So the delivery drivers and the healthcare workers, many of whom are at the lower end of the pay scales and aren't really respected by society. They were the ones that kept us going as the rest of us sheltered nicely in our homes and watched Netflix and just sort of hunkered down a bit. They were really sort of keeping things moving, and we haven't necessarily as societies valued those people. Hence, we have horrible employment contracts and arrangements and those things. And so that's really interesting, because a lot of the things that you're talking about there, again, would require us to shift how we think about things. But I have a sense that things are shifting slightly in that direction with ESG and various other movements where we're starting to think a bit more in those terms, albeit that there's a hell of a long way to go.
I think there is definitely a hell of a long way to go. I'm not sure if I'm that as optimistic, really. I mean, we had to really, really be forced and drilled. It had to be drilled into us to wear our masks to protect others rather than ourselves. And, you know, if it's for ourselves, sure, we'll put the mask on. If it's for others, I'm not so sure. I mean, we engaged eventually, but I think it does take a lot for us, in at least in the Western world, for us to really do things for the betterment. But I think we can all benefit from that. And I think if we see that the benefit in it for all of us, we're more likely to do it.
I love that. I don't know, maybe I'm just trying to, it's a glass is half full, most of it, but I think you make a really good point. And it's been an interesting experiment in what do we, you know, what would we like to think of ourselves as doing, or what do we actually do? Right. And you're spot on in terms of the sort of COVID piece. I would throw in, since both of us in the UK at the moment, I would throw in the beautiful mix-up. I'm not sure the best examples were always set at the top of the shop, as we discovered.
Wow, there is that.
So I think it's sort of difficult to role model that. If you haven't got the right leadership setting the tone, then that's not going to help either. But yeah. I take the point around the society and the way that those things operate. If people want to get hold of you to find out more, is there a way that we can do that?
Absolutely. I can leave my email address. No problem.
Fantastic. Well, I won't put your email address in the show notes, but I'll put a link to be so that people can manage to get hold of you. Because I think you would have sparked some interesting pieces. Mm-hmm. Odessa, thank you so much. One, for the work that you're doing, because I think it's really important and really interesting. And I'm a huge fan of what Grace is generally doing. You're a key part of that. So I'm absolutely delighted to have spent some time with you learning more about it. I wish you all the success in the world. And do, as and when you discover things, please do feel free to come back on the show to tell us about them.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
So that's it for this episode of the Human Risk Podcast. My huge thanks to Odessa for appearing and to you for listening. To find out more about the Inclusion Initiative and to listen to episodes featuring other people from it, have a look in the show notes. There are links to those there. If this is your first time listening to the Human Risk Podcast, welcome. You can subscribe wherever you get your quality audio content. It's available on all of the major podcasting platforms. To find out more about human risk and the work that I do with my clients, visit human-risk.com. I'll be back very soon with another episode of this show, but in the meantime, have lots of success, and remember, sometimes it's down to talent, and sometimes it's just down to luck. Either way, I wish you lots of all of it. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.